Yep, the cartoonist, Charles Adams. In this portion of the program, we're going to sort fact from fiction with Adams's biographer, Linda Davis. She is the author of Chas Adams, A Cartoonist's Life. Listeners, you can join the conversation with a telephone call this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments about Charles Adams for our guest. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Linda Davis is the author of three books, including a biography of Catherine White, Onward and Upward, and a biography of Stephen Crane, Badge of Courage. Her new book, A Biography of Charles Adams, is published by Random House. Again, the phone numbers to join the conversation this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Linda Davis, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Did Adams enjoy his reputation as being a bit sinister, a bit mad?
I think he got a little bit of a kick out of it, but people took it too far, and then it got tiresome. When he became very famous after the Adams Family TV show went on the air in 1964 to 1966, it invaded his privacy was invaded a little bit too much. He couldn't go to his little home in West Hampton Beach and sit outside on the porch and have a drink without people driving by in boats and waving and snapping their fingers to the Adams Family theme song. And they'd point at his friends and say, "There's Charles Adams with some of his strange friends." So it got to be a little bit much.
Yeah. Now, how did the rumors get started, rumors about eyeballs and coffins and the like?
I think it just started with the cartoons as soon as he began drawing them in the 30s. People, I think, in this country particularly, tend to be very literal-minded about artists and writers. They think, well, if you draw it, you must live it. If you've written about it, you must have actually experienced it. And they just didn't know anything about him. And people were curious about him all over the world. Everywhere there was the New Yorker. People wanted to know, what is Charles Adams really like? And to this day, these rumors persist. I was at a dinner party in September, and someone insisted to me that a particular rumor was true. And I said, no, it wasn't. So I hope they'll stop believing some of those things now.
Well, now, once they pick up your book,
yeah,
they'll know the...
He didn't actually sleep in a coffin. He was very civilized. And he didn't drink martinis with eyeballs in them. But there was a little truth to some of the rumors in that he did have a fantastic collection of medieval crossbows, which he kept mounted on the wall of his apartment in Manhattan, and he knew how to use them. He would have them restrung at the Metropolitan Museum. He had a fantastic Maximilian suit of medieval armor, and perhaps most sinister was his coffee table, which was made from an embalming table of the Civil War era and had the rusted metal headrest still attached. And as he said, a rather sinister stain in the region that would have been the kidneys. And he kept a Baccarat glass on it and a ceramic bowl of nesting snakes and other decorative plates and things like that on it. And he did get a genuine kick out of those things, but some of it was a little bit of a gag because that's what people expected from Charles Adams.
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful picture of him early in the book with a suit of armor.
Mm-hmm. That was taken by Nancy Crampton for a magazine article, and you'll notice in the picture he's wearing the helmet from the Maximilian suit of armor, which is standing behind him, looking beheaded,
right?
Because just the stock where the helmet is supposed to rest is there, and he's sitting in a normal, very nice jacket and tie and slacks and highly polished shoes, but with the suit, with the medieval helmet on, and looking quite comfortable, I think.
Yeah. It looks like he's enjoying himself.
He was.
It seems like he was a man who, by and large, really enjoyed life.
He did. And in fact, more than one of his friends said to me that she had never known anybody with his joie de vivre, with his childlike enthusiasm for things. Many, many people felt that way about him. I don't think anybody I've ever known enjoyed his or her life more than Charles Adams did.
Yeah.
Or lived as much in the world and knew as many people. He was on the top of everybody's dinner party invitation list and dated everybody, as you suggested in your wonderful opening.
Yeah. And even at the end, when he died, one of the last cartoons he was working on. Tell us about that.
Do you mean the Humpty Dumpty cartoon?
Thinking about the Newsroom, but...
Oh, yes. You know, I don't know when he actually did that.
Okay.
But there was a drawing. He did draw a lot of cartoons having to do with death and the hereafter, hell, the river Styx, things like that. Well, this cartoon was, this was just done in rough form. It was never worked up as a finish. And it showed a city newsroom crowded with desks and reporters. And there's somebody at the obituary's desk on the phone, and he's laughing as he's taking down the information. And that really summed up Charles' attitude toward death, which was basically that it's something we all face, and we might as well have a laugh out of it if possible.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to get my hands on a copy of that cartoon and put it with my last wishes. You know, please. I also would like a party, not, you know, a
instead
funeral.
Of a funeral. Yeah. And he had a great party. His widow had a great party for him because he hated funerals. He hated sermons. He hated the hard pews that you had to sit on. It was all so dreary and sad. And he said to his wife, his last wife, please don't ever do that to me. And she didn't. She threw him a fabulous party at the New York Public Library with an open bar and music playing and cartoons all around on stands and good food and good friends and colleagues.
Yeah. Tell us about her. She was a wonderful person.
She was a wonderful person. I'm very sorry to say she died in 2002 on Thanksgiving, is no longer with us. And they had been friends for over 40 years when they got married. They were both married to other people. They had a little bit of a love affair, and then it was off, and they became friends again. And then they finally came together when they were both free at the beginning of the 1970s. She was widowed, and he had been divorced for many years. And they lived together on and off, but mostly part-time on the weekends, for 8 years before she dragged him to the altar. Because he'd been married and divorced twice, and he used to say, why get married and spoil it all? But he was getting older, and he had some health problems, and she felt that it was important that they be legally married so that if somebody needed to sign something, if he was unconscious, she could do it. And she was a wonderful woman. She matched his wit. They both loved animals. They both loved to picnic in cemeteries, and she loved to play along with all of these gags. Kids would sometimes call the house and giggling and say, is Uncle Fester there? And Mrs. Adams, without missing a beat, would say, I'm sorry, he's just stepped out to the garden. Can I take a message?
And everybody called her T.
T-E-E. It was a childhood nickname. Her real name was Marilyn, and for some reason she hated the name Marilyn, so she always went by the name of T.
T and Charlie.
They were a great couple.
Yeah. The first chapter you have titled Arrested at the Age of 8, and the title comes from an answer he gave to an interviewer. But, you know, here's the question. What was Charles Adam like as a child?
Well, he was actually a very nice kid, but a little bit mischievous. He wasn't actually arrested at the age of 8, but he got into a little bit of trouble. He and some other boys broke into this wonderful Victorian house that was under repair, and they filled the carpenter's shoes with mortar, and he drew skeletons all over the wall, and the policeman came to his house, and his father had to go down to the station and pay a fine. And he liked to refer to that as his big arrest, but he wasn't really arrested. He would steal little tomatoes from a neighbor's garden and that sort of thing. Nothing, no serious breaking and entering or criminal activity. He was a nice kid. He He was a beloved only child, raised by his mother and father and his grandmother, maternal grandmother, Grandma Speer, who lived in the house with them and was the inspiration for Grandma Adams of the Adams family, which is not to say that she baked bat cookies for Charlie or did anything sinister, and she didn't look that awful. I found only one picture of her when she was much, much younger, and she was a perfectly normal-looking woman, but apparently in his imagination, or maybe she didn't age so gracefully, he said that Grandma Speer was a lot like Grandma Adams just before breakfast. And he liked to slide down the laundry chute and scare her when she was baking pies and things like that. And on at least one occasion, she spanked him, and my sympathies are with her. He would jump out and surprise her and scare the wits out of her. But he really had a very normal, happy boyhood in Westfield, New Jersey.
Typical shenanigans of a boy.
That's right.
But I would imagine that his graffiti, those skeletons he drew in that Victorian, by the way, house under repair, were probably better than what we were capable of as children.
Oh, I think they were. I mean, because he was drawing from the time he could hold a crayon in his little baby hand from about the age of two and never stopped and always wanted to be an artist, knew what he wanted to be from the time he was little. And so his boyhood stuff was pretty good, actually.
Yeah. That brings me to think about his Latin cartoons, although he probably would have called them his Latin scrawlings.
Oh, yes, for Latin class, or in making fun of Latin class, he used to do gag cartoons, and one of his friends in school would actually do the text, because Charlie got a C in Latin, so I don't think he actually wrote the Latin text, but they would do these gag bits about who come to bury Caesar and that sort of thing. The student in the cartoon would say, "We come to bury Caesar, not to praise him." And the teacher would say, "Who said this?" The student would say, "Some undertaker." So the Adams humor was there even then.
Yeah, and he was funny, not only in his cartoons, but he had a quick and wonderfully sharp wit.
Yes, he did, and I think that's very unusual, not only for cartoonists, but for comic geniuses who tend to put, you know, most of that, if not all of that, into their art, and then you meet them at a cocktail party and they don't have anything funny or witty to say. But he really was very quick-witted and very, very funny.
Mm. Now, these scrawlings, when did they become, how did they become the sophisticated drawings that we know as the work of Charles Adams?
Well, they really didn't become the sophisticated work until the 1930s. The New Yorker bought Charles Adams' first sketch as a spot drawing, which is used to fill space in at the end of a column of type in the New Yorker, in 1932 when he was 20. 1933, they bought his first cartoon. And the early cartoons are not recognizable as Charles Adams cartoons. They were done in the simple pen line style that was very popular during that day, but they were funny, and he was really holding his own. By 1935, he started to experiment with wash, which is ink that is artfully diluted with water, and that gave his cartoons this painterly look and allowed him to shade and gradually created the look that everybody knows as Charles Adams. By 1938, that was really his style. For a while, he went back and forth in style. So he was still pretty young when he found his style. He was a freelance by the age of 23 in 1935, and that's during the middle of the Depression.
Yeah. Well,
making his living by art alone.
Yeah. Now, did he become a staff cartoonist?
Well, they didn't have staff cartoonists. Everybody was paid on a worked on a freelance basis. They, in the early days, no cartoonists had offices at the New Yorker. That changed later. But you made your living according to what you sold, and you could do a lot of cartoons before making a sale. So there was no staff, there was no salary, and his income varied. It went up and down always.
Hmm. Now, when did he begin drawing the more sinister, the macabre cartoons?
It started coming in 1935. There were two cartoons he did that year that really began it. One was done in the penline style, and it showed a printing press, an ordinary printing press, with the New York Times rolling off, and the technician who's standing at the press notices that in the midst of all these papers headed the New York Times is a tabloid that's somehow got in the middle, and the heading on the tabloid is Sex Fiend Slays Tot. And he's very, very startled to see this. So there's the sinister element. But a little while later, Charles Adams submitted another cartoon that was done in the Wash style, and it showed some people on a roller coaster that was beginning its steep ascent, and in the front row of the car, a woman is gesturing up to her husband and saying, "Look, Alfred, vultures." And high above the roller coaster are these two birds. That was really the beginning, because that was the first cartoon that married the Wash style, although it was in a more primitive form than what he came to do with the sinister subject matter.
Yeah. What was the reaction on the part of readers?
Well, readers loved his work to begin with, mm-hmm. even before he was doing the sinister stuff. They were writing into the New Yorker. There were a few letters anyway saying, when are we going to have more Charles Adams cartoons? But he found it difficult to come up with ideas. It wasn't drawing that was hard for him. It was coming up with a good idea. And then, of course, they love the sinister stuff. But I think he's so known for the sinister stuff today, people forget that that wasn't all he drew. A lot of the cartoons were just funny, and a lot of them were characterized by great sweetness and gentleness, actually.
Hmm. Can you give us an example?
Well, the one that I referred to at the beginning of our talk was a cartoon he did just before he died. He sold it to the New Yorker, and it was published posthumously. And it's Humpty Dumpty in the elevator. It shows an open elevator in which stands a very sweet-looking Humpty Dumpty with little pointy elf shoes, and his hands are folded demurely behind his back. And he's looking at these two men who are standing outside the elevator. There's a lighted arrow above him pointed down. And the man to the far left is a conventional-looking businessman with a briefcase and a hat, and he's talking to the man nearest the elevator. And when you look closely, you see something a little strange looking about this other man who has apparently just stepped off the elevator with Humpty Dumpty. He's kind of got an ovoid head, and his face looks kind of like Humpty Dumpty's. And when you look at his hair, it appears to be a toupee. And the man, the businessman on the far left, is saying to him, "I think I'll wait for the next elevator." And it's one of those cartoons that Adams particularly loved because it made you work a little bit to find the joke. It's not immediately apparent. You have to study it a bit. And it's just, it's very, very sweet. He loved to draw Humpty Dumpty and Tweedledee and Tweedledum and other characters from Alice in Wonderland, which he drew beautifully.
Well, I'm glad we got back to that cartoon because we kind of charged off, and I left that hanging, didn't I? So,
well, you know, it's not really very well known. Yeah. To my surprise, it's never been anthologized. I think it was just published in the New Yorker after Adams died. And I think now it's been published in my book, and I hope people publish it again because it's a really beautiful cartoon. And I find it particularly touching because he did do it just before he died, and he was a little more fragile then and having some health problems, and I think that it sort of expresses that, but in a rather sweet, optimistic way.
Mm. Biographer Linda Davis is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book, Chaz Adams, A Cartoonist's Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments about the cartoonist Charles Adams. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800 222 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I suspect that when most of us hear the name Charles Addams, the first thing we think about is the family he created, the Addams family. When did he begin drawing those characters?
Well, he began drawing them in 1938, but they weren't a family then. There were only two characters, the woman we came to know as Morticia and her butler, Lurch. They were never named in the cartoons. They weren't named until the television series came along. But Lurch had a beard in the first drawing, and Morticia's hair was pulled back in a bun. And there were only two of those cartoons in the 30s, and then they really took off in the 40s. It was Harold Ross, the founding editor of the magazine, who suggested to Charles Addams that he add more characters to that haunted house and create a family, which Addams had no intention of doing when he did the first cartoon. It was just kind of a one-shot idea in his mind. So most of the Addams Family cartoons appeared during the 40s and 50s, only a couple before that and very few after that.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I remember them as a child. Well, first of all, I think my first experience with a Charles Addams cartoon was in a collection of New Yorker cartoons that was published to celebrate the magazine's 25th anniversary, and it belonged to my parents and probably might have belonged to my grandparents before that. But it was a wonderful book to pore over, and a lot of the cartoons I was too young to get, but the Charles Addams cartoons, featuring the Addams family in particular, were just hilarious. And the skier, you know, that's another one that I remember from my childhood. Do you recall the first time you had your first Charles Addams moment as a kid?
Well, I'm ashamed to say that I really didn't discover his work until I was an adult, the original cartoons. I was 11 years old in 1964 when the Addams Family TV show came on. And my brother and I were glued to it.
Yeah.
Every week we watched it. And we liked it better than the Munsters, and I'm not just saying that. we really did, although we watched the Munsters too. My parents did not subscribe to the New Yorker, and I just never discovered it until I was in my early 20s, I think. So it was really much later before I saw the cartoons, which were much more sinister than the television show,
by the way.
Addams complained that although he liked the TV show pretty well, that they were not half as evil as my people.
Yeah. let's talk with a listener. On line one in Champaign, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I think you just answered the question, but I always wondered whether that famous cartoon of the tree standing in the middle of a field with snow all around, and there's a right ski track on the right side of the tree and a left ski track on the left side of the tree. Did he do that cartoon?
Yes, he did, and that was called The Skier, which Les was referring to earlier.
That's one of the most famous cartoons ever.
It was. That was the cartoon that made him world famous. It wasn't the Addams Family.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that was published in 1940, and it was and made waves all over the world, apparently.
Yeah,
he was just astonished by the response to that cartoon.
One other quick question. My father was a cartoonist, and he had a lot of cartoonist friends. My pop did Major Hoovel for a long time in the 30s. And all his friends who were cartoonists looked like their characters. H.C. Webster, for example, looked exactly like Catherine Milquetoast. Otto Soglo looked like the Little King.
Mm-hmm.
The only guy who didn't fit this mold was Ham Fisher, and he didn't look anything like Joe Palooka.
Well,
I was wondering whether Charles Addams looked like any of his characters.
Well, actually, he did. He looked like Uncle Fester, only he had more hair, as he said. Although Uncle Fester was a hideous version of what Charles Addams looked like. Charles Addams looked like Walter Matthau, actually, and was often mistaken on the street for him, which was doubly funny because he knew Walter Matthau and his wife, Carol. He was a nice-looking man, but people didn't know his face.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Some time back, I talked with Bob Mankoff of the New Yorker cartoonist, and you know, we talked about this very thing, and he said, "Yeah, the cartoonists look like they're cartoons."
I think that's true in a lot of cases. Saul Steinberg looked mm-hmm. a bit like the characters when he drew characters in his cartoons. I've seen pictures of George Booth. I don't think he looks anything like the characters in his cartoons. But it is certainly true of a lot of them.
Yeah.
I guess you draw what you love, huh?
Yeah. Well, okay, so now we have the uncle who looks a little bit like Charles, only Charles with more hair. And Grandma was mm-hmm. modeled after Grandma.
Mm-hmm.
Were there the other members of the family, the figure that became known as Morticia, mm-hmm. was she modeled on someone?
No. Well, she was a little bit, there was a little bit of Gloria Swanson, the actress
yeah.
in her. And also in that very first drawing in 1938, there's a little bit of Elsa Lanchester as she looked in the 1935 movie Bride of Frankenstein.
Uh-huh.
But Adams always said it was just a type of beauty that he liked. You know, slinky and thin, dark hair, pale skin. And he drew what he loved,
yeah.
whether he got the idea from the film stars of the 30s or he'd seen a woman like that first, he never explained.
Yeah.
So she, as far as I know, she was never modeled. The rumor was that she was modeled on his first wife, but his first wife came along later. He wasn't married till 1943, and Morticia was already here by then. And none of the other characters were modeled on actual people, as far as I know. Although, there's a little bit of Thomas E. Dewey in Gomez, but Thomas E. Dewey crossed with a pig.
That was his way of saying what, Gomez was all about.
Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of the old actor Peter Lorre in Gomez,
yeah.
too. Pugsley is just kind of your universal bad boy, a miniature W.C. Fields. I don't know where Little Wednesday came from, but she seems, in her dress anyway, influenced by the Amish. She loved Pennsylvania Dutch country. I don't know where he got the idea for that wonderful little face. And Lurch was inspired somewhat by Boris Karloff's Frankenstein. I think there's a little of Lon Chaney and Phantom of the Opera in there, too.
Very interesting. And Pugsley, he had a different name for Pugsley, but right?
Yes, he did. He was asked to name the characters around the time of the TV show. There was a company called Aboriginals who started making dolls based on the family before the TV show started, and then they tied them in with the TV show, and so Adams was asked to name the characters. And he came up with the name Pubert for Pugsley. And the people who made the dolls thought it was a dirty name. So he changed it to Pugsley, which was the name of a little stream in the Bronx.
Let's talk with another listener. A caller in Savoy on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Perhaps you mentioned this already, but was he the son of the famous historian and the presidential Adams families?
Well, aren't you the clever one? And this is something nobody really knows. He wasn't a direct descendant, but he was indirectly descended from a third cousin of President John Adams on his mother's side. And he was a cousin of Jane Adams on his father's side, first cousin twice removed. So that's somebody nobody knows.
Well, what about the historian Adams?
Which historian?
Charles Adams.
I'm not sure which historian you mean. There's a historian named Charles
Adams?
He was
20th century, late 19th and early 20th century.
Is it spelled with two D's?
No.
No. Oh. I never found him in the genealogy, but certainly he has a distant connection to John Adams and John Quincy Adams and
Ooh.
Jane Adams. So that's pretty illustrious.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Okay, now here's a couple of questions. When did the second D come along in the name, and why did he sign his drawings Chaz?
Okay, the second D came along because Charles Adams' great-great-great-grandfather lived near a man named Adams, and as the story goes, he wanted to distinguish himself from his neighbor, so he added the D to the name.
Okay.
And his son was John High Adams, who knew Abraham Lincoln, and Lincoln used to call him my dear double deed Adams.
Oh.
He was also the father of Jane Adams. And then you asked me a question about
why he signed his cartoons, his drawings, the way he did.
Chaz Adams.
Right.
Because he said it looked better.
Yeah.
It was more economical, and it did.
Yep.
Of course, he had a great, great handwriting and a wonderful signature, too, which helps.
Yeah. Linda Davis, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Chaz Adams, A Cartoonist's Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk next with the listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Oh, hi. Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
What a great book. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've always really liked his work. I'm not old enough to have seen his work in its original form in the 40s and 50s, but I sort of picked up on it when I had, you'd have these compilations of his work from The New Yorker. As a matter of fact, later on when I sort of started reading The New Yorker when I was about 15 in 1965, I guess they would have, print some of his older stuff. And I've always thought his work was really fascinating. I'm so interested in listening to you because I never knew anything about him. I'm quite sure, like a lot of these people, they stay in the background. But I was going to ask you if I think he heavily influenced Gahan Wilson, the cartoonist who's living now,
mm-hmm.
and others. And I'm not so much sure stylistically, but I was really interested in seeing how you described how he developed his style from the simple line drawings, which are now even returning in New Yorker with B.E.K.'s work. I don't remember the writer's name, but more of a wash, and how he sort of brought this Victorian idea to the mid-19th century or 20th century. But I was wondering if you could talk about, did you know of his influences? I'm sure he's really an original. I mean, he probably didn't have many content influences, but did you find any of his, not just stylistic, but maybe people that maybe did work similar to his? Not the Adams family, but the sort of sarcasm, that sort of undertow of a Halloween scare, I guess, the best word to say. Thank
right.
You.
I don't think he was influenced by any contemporaries. He was certainly, as you said, completely original at The New Yorker when he started doing his thing, and he found his sinister subject matter and the wash technique. There was nobody else doing that at The New Yorker. But what was even more original, really, and widespread, because not all of his work dealt with macabre subject matter, was this juxtaposition of the world of fantasy or myth with everyday life, and his sense of wonder at the magic in everyday mm-hmm. life. For instance, he would draw a cartoon like one in the 50s, which showed a woman walking down a Manhattan street corner, toward a Manhattan street corner in a high wind, kind of gripping her hat, and in front of her blows the Mad Hatter's hat. It's a captionless cartoon. And if you don't know Alice in Wonderland and the Tenniel illustrations, you wouldn't recognize that that is the Mad Hatter's hat. Nobody else was seeing the world that way and drawing that kind of cartoon. The juxtaposition of myth, of the literary world, with the so-called real world. And that simply came from his literacy, from his imagination. Like many writers, he lived with one foot in the world of fantasy and books, and the other in the so-called real world. And his early influences were artists such as Gustave Doré and Arthur Rackham and Tenniel and Alfred Ryder. And there's, some magnificent artists of the 19th century and 18th century. So does that answer your question about his originality? I do think he's influenced Gayan Wilson and Gary Larson and Edward Ed Gorey. Whether they acknowledged an influence or not, I think he was an influence.
Yeah. I wonder if he has been an influence to somebody like Lemony Snicket.
You know, he probably was, even if it was subconsciously. The author of Lemony Snicket is a pretty young guy, I think.
Yeah.
Is he in his 30s now? Or
we're going to talk with him for a brief interview next week at some point, so I'll ask him.
Oh, good. Let me know what he says.
Yeah. You know, one of the wonderful things I think about Charles Adams' cartoons is that sense of wonder and magic. And sometimes even, you know, the sinister ones, I don't know, they're, it's like he's winking at us and he's saying, come on, let's share this.
Yes. I think the important thing for people to understand about the sinister cartoons is that no blood is ever spilled in those cartoons. This is part of the Adams wit. He took his cue from the Greeks, in the Greek plays, in which the violence always happens off stage. In the hands of a lesser artist, you would see the act of violence. You know the famous Adams cartoon known as Boiling Oil, which has the ghouls at the top of the Victorian mansion about to tip a cauldron of boiling oil, or as Harold Ross thought of it, boiling lead, but the cartoon's known as Boiling Oil, onto the heads of a group of Christmas carolers who are singing their hearts out at the front door. Now, the important thing to remember is there's no oil spilled. In fact, you don't even see a bubbling drop about to come over the lip of the cauldron.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's the impulse, the darker human impulse that he's illustrating.
Yeah.
Somebody drawing for Mad Magazine would have showed the oil spilling and the poor carol is being scalded. That wouldn't have been funny. Or Uncle Fester on a mountain, driving on a mountain pass, which is a blind curve, signaling to the couple in the car behind him to go ahead and pass. What they don't see is that in front of Uncle Fester is this enormous truck coming. But you don't see the crash.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, a little bit of road rage and irritation. People tailgating, I suppose.
When you set out, did you know or suspect Adams was such a complicated man?
No, and I didn't know he was such a marvelous subject. I think I started the biography just to find out who he was. I knew very, very little. It's a little bit risky to commit yourself to a biography, which typically means years of your life,
mm-hmm.
without knowing very much about him, because you could make a mistake. And then you're stuck and you have a contract and an advance you've probably already spent and have to pay it back. But he was even better. He was a better subject. He was richer, more complex than I ever could have imagined, and truly the most sympathetic person
mm-hmm.
I've ever written about. I never found anybody in this world who disliked Harold, thinking of Ross again, Charles Adams. Even an ex-wife, and he had two of them before he married
T. Yeah. Well, as you write in the book, he made a friend of all his lovers, all the women that he loved.
That's true. They all stayed friends. The ex-wives stayed friends. All the ex-girlfriends stayed friends. That takes a pretty extraordinary person to carry that off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a wonderful read, and it's great to get to know someone who we all have so enjoyed his cartoons. So thank you very much for writing the book and for talking with us this afternoon, Linda.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Linda Davis has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of Chaz Adams, A Cartoonist's Life. The book is published by Random House.